Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, everyone in the franchise world. My name is Paul Segreto, and this is Franchise Today. Boy, I just hope everybody that has friends and families throughout the South and the Southeast have found them safe and out of harm's way with those tremendous tornadoes and horrible weather running through there. And I know today's guest, Lee Plave, is in the Virginia area, and I know they were fighting some power outages and stuff, but I'm happy to say that he will be on here with us today. Well, this is the third week in our second annual franchise legal series on Franchise Today, and co-producer Joe Caruso has scheduled another riveting topic of discussion, social media within franchising, a legal perspective. And who better to discuss that with me today than Lee Plave, owner at Plave Cook PLC. But before we get to the heart of today's show, I'd like to do a few things. First, I'd like to wish safe travels to everybody leaving the multi-unit conference in Las Vegas. Hope you all get home well. First, I'd also like to thank last week's guest, Jonathan Redgrave, for providing us with some great information about the legal issues surrounding social media and e-discovery. And if you've yet to listen to last week's segment, I highly recommend you do, and it's available on demand at blogtalkradio.com/franchisetodayshow. Also, let's take a look at the rest of the lineup Joe Caruso has in store for us as the Franchise Legal Series continues next week with Warren Lee Lewis as my guest. Warren, as many know, is of the Ackerman Centerfeet Law Firm, and Warren and I will be discussing franchise sales best practices with a probable journey through his great publication, The Franchise Seller's Handbook, and that's next week, May 5th. Yes, that's Cinco de Mayo, so don't pick up the margaritas or the Coronas until after the show. Then the following week on May 12th, Leslie Curran, also of Plave Cook, will be my guest as we discuss franchise broker issues in a digital world. And I hope an hour is enough time for that topic, as I can already think of so many potential issues I'd like to discuss. Well, I'm looking forward to my discussion with Leslie, as I am with all my guests. There's just so much to talk about, and the information is so spot on when it comes to franchise best practices that I'm excited by the entire series. Okay, there's still more about the Franchise Legal Series to discuss, and the following week on May 19th, my guest will be Adam Siegelheim of Stark & Stark. Adam will be reporting on his experience at the then-completed IFA Legal Symposium. So if you're not attending the symposium in Washington, D.C. earlier that week, this will be a great opportunity to learn about some of the highlights. Then the following week on May 26th, right before the Memorial Day weekend, I will be joined by franchisee attorney Michael Webster. And as many may recall from last year's Franchise Legal Series, Michael is the strategic chair for the Independent Association of Franchisees and Dealers. And Michael and I will be discussing independent franchisee associations and why franchisors should love them. And that, of course, will be the end of the seven-part Franchise Legal Series. And then in June, we will be starting our multi-part Franchise Finance Series. I also hope to have Jack Earl, the current IFA chairman, who will be fresh back from his trip with Steve Caldera to China, and I'd love to get some input on that as well. As you know, Jack was supposed to be on the show a few weeks back, but we had some technical difficulties and was not able to connect. And as much as he's traveling around to Europe and Asia and what have you, and as busy as he is, we were not able to reschedule, and hopefully we'll be able to do that in June. At least we have a tentative agreement to do so. Well, enough of what the rest of the series looks like and what the future looks like. Today I'm excited to have Lee Plave as my guest on Franchise Today. Lee has extensive experience counseling distributors and franchisors, including drafting and negotiating franchise agreements for complex international and domestic transactions and advising all clients on aspects of franchise and distribution law. He also counsels clients on the application of technology to franchise and distribution systems, including matters such as e-commerce, policies regarding data use and security, cyber squatting and domain name disputes, consumer complaint, and cyber measure sites. software and hardware licensing, and issues relating to online and internet services. In addition, he represents clients in matters before the Federal Trade Commission, where he practiced from 83 to 87 before entering private practice. Lee, that was a mouthful. Welcome to Franchise Today.
Thanks for having me, Paul.
You know, before we get started, I'd like to ask you a question off topic. On your website, there's a statement, Franchise Law with Zing. Would you care to explain that?
Well, we launched our firm 4 years ago as an outpost for several of us from the largest law firms in the world. And we just thought that Zing represented a fresh attitude and a fresh new approach. And I could tell you that in the 4 years since, there are 10 of us, 10 partners. We have we take our work very seriously. We don't take ourselves that seriously. We have a lot of fun. Our office is a wonderful environment, and I guess Zing is just an attitude of an expression of joy as we do what we do.
Now that's great, and I know too. You know, today we're going to be talking about social media within franchising, and you recently had the honor and pleasure of visiting Google and Facebook at their headquarters. Is that correct?
Yeah, it's quite an experience.
What was that like?
Well, it's a step into a world that corporate law is not that that close to in many respects. But the great part about going there is to see the attitude of both of the companies. I think Facebook's attitude sums it up best. On the wall, there was a scrolled phrase. It was "Move fast, break things," and that really sums up their approach to things. They just in this last several days have launched their new initiative in this area, which is a very interesting and exciting one, which is their Facebook Deals concept, which is a location-based service that will provide enhanced opportunities for franchisors and franchisees to interact with their customers. Facebook Deals is supposed to compete in many respects with Groupon and Living Social. Google will probably find that it's going to get into the same business. They've got something called Google Offers. So you've now got various companies that are trying to connect users in their online lives with the businesses they frequent. And I think the opportunities are tremendous, both on the business side as well as on the consumer side.
Absolutely. I read, too, about Facebook Deals. And I understand it's initially launched in 5 cities, including Dallas, San Francisco, and 3 other cities. And, you know, social media in the forms of Facebook and, of course, Twitter, YouTube, and LinkedIn have achieved unprecedented popularity, which seems to have happened almost overnight. And in relative terms, it has, since the oldest of these platforms is just 7 years old. In the good old days, franchising had, you know, websites, email, print, direct mail, TV, and radio to promote unit-level sales and the sale of franchises. I even remember when the big thing was to do, you know, VHS videos and do a half-an-hour infomercial. And on the one hand, social media is a great opportunity. On the other hand, it's certainly not risk-free. And I know last week, Jonathan Redgrave, my guest, had told us some of the trials and tribulations. You know, Lee, what's your take generally on the social media revolution, evolution, and specifically within franchising?
Well, it presents remarkable opportunities, but it also presents the opportunity to put your brand out there in a way that that on the one hand affords the possibility of almost untold connection with your consumer base. Of course, the flip side to that is that it also provides the opportunity for untold challenges to and threats to the brand name. I met with a bunch of folks just last night in a local entrepreneurs group here in Washington, and many of them were talking about some of the pros and cons of franchising, and they hit the nail on the head. One of them said, gee, I was interested, but I found out that Company X had a problem in Missouri, and all of a sudden people who I asked knew the company only by virtue of that problem. And while that's potentially unfair, that's the power and strength of brands, is you buy into a brand, and the brand has strengths, and it potentially has weaknesses. The fact that it occurs in social media or social networking as the venue doesn't change that dynamic all that much. The challenges are still there.
You know, in terms of franchisors, you know, leveraging social media, two areas that concern many the most have to do with the consumer proposition, or B2C, and then, of course, franchise lead, you know, generation and new unit development.
Right.
And, you know, the other day you had a tweet that was really intriguing about more moving parts in a franchisor's social networking policy than a Swiss watch. What was your reference to there?
Well, I was enjoying the chance to sit with some quiet time and go through a social media policy I've been working on. But there really are many different pieces to the puzzle. It goes well beyond the issue of approval and review. For example, you've got to set guidelines, because these are the sorts of things that people don't think of. There are a lot of facets to it. Every franchisee potentially needs to consider how to effectively distinguish her or his own personal page from their business page. What should be said on the personal page? What should be said on the business page? What should never be said on the personal page or done on the personal page? And what should, of course, never also be done on the business page? One example might be things like photographs of people using company uniforms as their daily fare when they're doing something that they really don't want to have associated with the business. That's at some level self-explanatory, but it's just another one of those details. Who is, for example, speaking on behalf of the franchisee? Is the franchisee transparent when it goes on a site and says, I really love this business, and it's their own business? If they're not transparent, somebody is going to eventually figure out that Joe or Jane works for the franchisee and is going to effectively reveal that, which not only devalues that posting, but it also makes everybody look like they're in on some sort of a cross-endorsement deal that doesn't make any sense, which raises yet another issue, the FTC's rules on promotions and endorsements online. So you've got those several issues. You've got media considerations. You have the potential for defamation, for libel. When people exchange views, sometimes those conversations aren't as pleasant as they should be. Sometimes people go to their competitors' websites. You've got some businesses that will post information, for example. This one that I was working on the other day happened to be in food service. Not all are. And if a franchisee inadvertently says something about the nutritional value of the food that it serves, that may trigger a whole set of obligations with respect to disclosure of food nutrition information that otherwise don't exist. You've got to have a policy that's intelligent as to things like consumer comments and complaints. What happens if and when the discussion ever turns ugly? And then you've got basic legal standards like not using somebody else's content, obtaining consent if you want to put up a picture of a customer or a customer's kid. Not everyone wants their kids' photos to be displayed online. It certainly is the case in some businesses that that's a central aspect of the business. For example, a business specializing in kids' parties. You need to be very careful that you actually have consent, because as much as you think it's fantastic to show the smiling and happy faces of the kids, not all of their parents might agree. So you've got a lot of those kinds of things, and then you've got to do that in the context of a company policy for the company's own employees, a franchisee policy, a policy the franchisees feel comfortable enough to articulate to and enforce with their own employees. And, of course, that all has to come after the parties have sat down and considered the issue, and really, most importantly, what's the strategy to be followed in all of this? So there are a lot of moving.
Yeah, there's always that to be that question of that cart before the horse scenario.
Yeah.
Of, well, I need to develop a social media policy, and some, you know, have contacted me, and certainly they should be contacting people like you with respect to a social media policy, but they want to do so first before developing the strategy? And of course, my question immediately is, well, if you develop a strategy and it has some specifics in there that have to do with Twitter, and ultimately your strategy doesn't involve Twitter, why would you have Twitter in your policy? So, you know, my recommendation is always, you know, develop the strategy, learn what your objectives are, identify them, because a lot of times there's multiple objectives that need various sub-strategies to accomplish what you're looking to accomplish. And, of course, at the end of the day also is, you know, why you're even in social media in the first place, and, of course, what you're looking to achieve by being in there and being able to figure out how you're going to manage the results. And I say once you have that strategy in place, then, of course, you need a policy so that and guidelines that everybody can work within. And, you know, there's a lot of questions that come up within the social media realm, within the various platforms, and probably most specifically within some of the LinkedIn franchise groups with respect to social media policy. There's been some that have said there shouldn't be a social media policy. There are some that say that it actually stifles creative marketing and are counter to the freewheeling spirit of social media engagement. And some say who better to do social media than the franchisees at the local level. I mean, what do you say to the policies that, you know, stifle the creative marketing and are counter to that freewheeling spirit of social media engagement?
Well, I think those kinds of observations miss the broader point, which is that social media is just yet another means by which you can market the business. And the business is the sale of products or services by franchisees to the public. And the medium may change, but the dynamic is the same. There is a need for there to be a coordinated, system-wide message for getting that information out to franchisees' customers, and there needs to be some review by somebody, and that somebody is in virtually all systems the franchisor. The fact that this takes place in social media doesn't change the dynamic. It's still the franchisor's trademark. If I say something in a franchise that I operate in the Washington, D.C. area, and it's something that's foolish, it's going to be seen not only by people in the Washington, D.C. area, but in fact, more broadly, it might be seen by somebody in Los Angeles, and a local franchisee's business might be injured by it. So everybody has got to sort of follow the same script or at least get approval for what they're doing. One other interesting dynamic about advertising online, whether it's in an old website, which now almost seems quaint, or in a social media or a social networking site. If you were to go and put an advertisement in the New York Times, the LA Times, the Chicago Tribune, or any paper, there's typically an advertising editor whose job is to make sure that you're not doing something colossally foolish, not violating the law. To whatever extent that editor can catch it, they're going to do so. But online, there's no advertising editor. The only filter is the person who hits the button that says post it. And not everybody has they may be fantastic marketers, wonderfully brilliant and innovative folks, and what they're thinking of doing may be exactly what the franchisor is willing to let take place. But if it's a foolish thing to be done, somebody has got to be able to step to have a moment in time to say, well, wait a second, did you consider the possibility that this is going to be offensive? And that process needs to take fold. It can't just be overlooked because it's social media or it's social networking.
Yeah, a lot of people don't think the same rules apply online as they do in person. Mm-hmm. And then, of course, they diminish it even further by putting some, you know, part-time intern in charge of their social media program, only to realize the potential consequences and repercussions if something goes awry. You know, you mentioned trademark. You know, how does a franchisor ensure that its trademarks are protected within social media, and how vigilant must they be?
Well, that's a very good question, and it's probably one of the hardest ones to deal with. In fact, the reason that that we visited with the executives at Facebook and Google was to try to tackle that very issue. And I think within a reasonably short period of time, we may actually be able to announce some substantial progress along those lines. But a couple of things that people can do practically as well as legally. First of all, have a policy. Have a policy that thoughtfully explains what is permitted and what is not permitted. So, for example, if we have Paul's Cookies as our franchise system, we're going to let people, assuming the company's strategy is to let franchisees have their own pages on a site, for example, like Facebook, we're going to let people go ahead and have pages, but we're going to give them pages that either exist independently with names that are consistent with the franchisor's naming convention for the businesses, like Paul's Cookies of Rockville, Maryland, Paul's Cookies of Washington, D.C., or it may be even more granular than that. And secondly, the franchisor is going to have control over those names because they're names just like domain names, just like trademarks and the like, or like DBAs in the old days. So you want to have that. Secondly, the franchisor will want to be a co-administrator of those sites so that there is some degree of control as to what goes on with those sites. But if you take some simple steps, you can effectively create a situation in which franchisees can go out and do the dynamic and interesting things within the context of having some element of system-wide coordination and control, which is an essential element of any franchise system.
You know, the way I look at it is just like a franchisee has the right to put the signage up on the front of their building if it's a bricks and mortar business, and obviously that signage is the logo, it's approved by the franchisor. I mean, to me, when there's an online site and you use the franchisor's brand name there, it's no different than what would be on the front of a bricks and mortar type of situation. So I definitely agree with you there. And, you know, again, a big part of the problems that I see is they just take it too lightly. And it made me think about something we talked about just before the show, you know, about one-size-fits-all type of scenarios, and there's a lot to be considered. And I'm sure you get phone calls all the time that say, you know, hey, Lee, I know you've written some social media policies. Can you send me, you know, a fill-in-the-blank so I can use it? What's your response to that?
Well, it's pretty much along the lines of there is no one-size-fits-all approach, and everybody takes it a different way. So, for example, while there are some common elements, if your strategy is to pursue a very hard B2C strategy, that is to say to drive consumers into the stores, and your franchisees have not yet gone on Facebook, you have various possibilities and opportunities that are fundamentally different than if your goal was to drive sales to an online store site, or if your goal was to drive sales to the stores, but your franchisees have already got system-wide Facebook pages or Twitter accounts from which they're continuously dealing with a fan base that's already established. You really have to know your starting point in order to know how do you start developing and implementing a policy to get you not just brand consistency, but where you want to go.
So what do you recommend to franchisors whose franchisees, in essence, got there first?
Well, you have several approaches. I've heard lawyers who've said, well, just tell them to take the sites down. That's all well and good, but, you know, I've got one client, for example, who's got a franchisee, the last I checked, had 4,500 or 4,600 followers on likes, I think is the newest phrase, on Facebook.
Right.
That's a very useful asset, not just to that franchisee, but to the system as a whole. We certainly don't want them to just take it down. We want to be able to make sure we can see what's going on that page. We can have an element of control and the like, but we want to make sure that we can preserve what they've already built because it's a valuable asset in all directions. What you try to do if franchisees have already gotten out there is work with them on a collaborative basis. The truth of it is that unless the franchisor has given carte blanche to its franchisees to do so, franchisees are not permitted to engage in that kind of an activity if the franchise agreement has some basic language in it, such as thou shalt not use my trademarks without my prior written approval, and thou shalt not advertise without my prior written approval. So unless somebody has waived those standards, the chances are pretty good that the franchisor has enough legal and moral authority to bring some element of coordination and control into the system, particularly if they use an intelligent and thoughtful approach to getting everybody onto the same page.
And I think there's the key, the intelligent approach. You know, yeah. I've run into that with some franchise clients where franchisees have already gotten into the social media arena before the franchisor. And they typically fall into two categories. You know, there's a big part of them that, you know, jumped in and did nothing with it. And obviously, those are easy situations to change because they've pretty much fallen by the wayside in their efforts. And then, like you said, there's some that have a dramatic influence online and a big following, and certainly you don't want to take that and you know, take it offline. And I have found a convince rather than demand scenario works best with those individuals and get them involved in putting together the overall strategy based in part of what they've already accomplished and try to work it in that way. And it seems to have worked very well in certain cases where I've been working with franchise clients. Where franchisees got there first. You mentioned something that was pretty interesting. You're talking about, you know, children's party franchises. And obviously there's a lot of picture taking and videos. What's the standard, if there is some, when parents have taken the pictures and the videos and posted them online, and then franchisees and franchisors have taken those pictures and videos off the parent sites, which are public sites, and put them on their own? What's your thought with respect to, you know, the written release aspect of it?
How many bells and alarms can go off simultaneously? Well, you've got a couple of things going. It's and it's an example of why this is not something that you just do lightly. If a parent takes the photo or the video of, let's say, you know, her son's birthday party, and posts it up on her page, and the franchisor realizes, oh, that was at my place. I'm gonna link it to my site. I'm gonna capture the video and share it up on the Lee's Jumping page site. A couple of things are going to happen. First of all, the parent, even though it's an open medium, the parent may not like that. And given the fact that it's such an open medium that somebody can easily endorse or post a negative comment, you'd certainly want to have the parents say so before you did anything like that, because the last thing in the world you want to do is post it up there only to find out that the parent puts on her own page, look what those so-and-sos did, they stole my video. That undercuts the value of the video in the first place. So I guess the first thing I would do is make sure that you've got the parents' permission, who is the one who's got the video up on her site. The second one is, the truth of it is that parent owns the copyright in the photo or the video. The person who takes the picture or takes the video or paints a picture or creates a work of art owns the copyright in it. So if you repost it for commercial purposes, you may be violating their copyright. So you would need a copyright clearance, which is not a hard thing to get, but it's just a step that you would want to take. And the last one is that while individual parents may take photos of their children's friends and post them, and parents probably won't object under those circumstances, it may be a different situation when a business does the same thing. But legally, it's really the same thing. If you're going to post a picture of somebody for commercial purposes, which is to say to advertise your business, you're now using it in a way that will clearly invoke the copyright laws and the right to publicity laws as well. You would be well advised not to do that unless you had somebody's permission to do it, especially with children. The heightened degree of scrutiny and concern in that regard could not be more acute. And I think it just illustrates the point that this is an area where inattention to important details can lead to damage that's far more than people would have thought on an area that seems so innocuous.
Yeah, and it brings up a good point, you know, and you touched on it when you were talking about the social media policy earlier, about social media crisis, how important is preparing for a social media crisis, whether it be big or small? It could be employees doing bad things on YouTube. I mean, we all are familiar with the Domino's situation.
Right.
Or it could be small about franchisees, you know, maybe getting numerous negative comments on Yelp. How important is it to prepare for a social media crisis?
Well, I think it's really it's part and parcel of the planning, and you hit the nail on the head on a couple of those. So, for example, there are very well known and prominent instances in which everything that could have gone bump in the night did, and then there are smaller level ones. Like, for example, somebody posts a negative comment on a franchisee's page, but it goes unresponded to, or it goes and it's endorsed. The negative comment, that is echoed by somebody else. And before the franchisor gets a chance to jump in, or the franchisee, it takes on a little bit of a life of its own. It just suggests that one of the things that you need to include in your policy is dealing with consumer complaints and consumer comments. But it's in general, it's just another way in which this phenomenon called cyber griping can be brought to bear. If you don't allow somebody to express their perspective on your page, let's say you have a business that automatically wipes off all negative comments, I think that's not only unrealistic, but it'll be seen pretty easily by people in the community as a company that's not willing to brook any dissent, and they're not interested in as much in what their customers think as a business that does it otherwise. In contrast, a business that says, in response to a negative post, very promptly, "We're really sorry you had a bad experience. Please give a call to our manager at the store so that we can learn more about what happened, try to correct any mistakes that were made, and try to do right by you." I think that's the kind of a message that says to a consumer, "We care about making sure that at the end of the day you have a good experience." So there's that at the micro level. That said, it's not responsible, nor is it necessary to permit somebody to post things to your page that are offensive, derogatory, threatening, or generally speaking, ugly. And I think one of the great social media policies out there, in fact, is from the Intel Corporation, which says just that: we're willing to accept comments that are negative. We're willing to accept comments that are critical of what we've done or what we might have said. But if it's ugly, defamatory, or it's out of context, we don't accept it, and we're not going to permit it. I think that's a reasonable way of approaching things. And then last but not least, and you don't have to put this in your policy that you disseminate, but you do need to consider it, is the point that you're driving at, which is what happens if something really big happens? And you need to have a policy internally as to what the crisis management team is going to look like, who is going to be involved in coming to some initial decisions, how to create an approach to deal with these issues. And it's just as much a consideration in the online world, whether it's in a conventional website or in a social media or a social networking site, as it would be if you had to deal with a car accident in the parking lot of your restaurant or other kinds of things.
Yeah, I almost think it's even more critical because things can move a lot faster online as opposed to something happening at 7 o'clock and you have to wait for the 10 o'clock news.
Yes.
3 hours online can be an eternity at times. And I hear what you're saying as far as, you know, certain brands I've seen, you know, take down all negative comments. Probably not brands as much as franchisees and small business owners take down all the negative comments. And I've seen them do that on Facebook. And my first question is, you know, if you tick off these people, they're going to go onto a platform where you have no control.
Yeah.
And it's going to be uglier. At least
exactly.
Within Facebook, you have a community and you can talk it out and resolve the situation, you know, squash the fire and move on. If you tick them off and they move someplace else on some type of gripe site, you have no control, and that's when it really can get viral and then also be picked up by people that have nothing to do with your brand and your online community.
Yeah, in fact, if you effectively enough shut down a consumer who wants to say his or her piece, all they have to do is go to their own page in
yeah.
Facebook and say, you know, I went to Lee's Cookies and it was a terrible experience and they won't even listen to me. And at that point, if you know about it at all, and you might not, you have no ability to control it because you certainly can't take a comment down on a consumer's own site. Yeah, there's a really good example actually in the last week of a company that was proactive in dealing with a horrible situation that was utterly outside of its control, and that was McDonald's Corporation did a good job. I mean, everyone can debate how effective it was, but they tried to right the wrong or at least deal with the damage done by a horrible assault that took place in a Baltimore area restaurant, and they issued in social media a comment of their own addressing the matter. And it's one of those things where you've really got to plan, you've got to expect the unexpected, and as you say, and I think correctly so, given the speed and the intensity with which these comments move about, you can't just ignore them. And I guess there's one other comment that I would share that's worth noting, and that is that much like we've all become accustomed to various things over the course of time, many of us are accustomed to seeing a negative review here and there and throwing it out. For example, I know that when my wife wants to take a trip, she'll go up on a website like TripAdvisor, and she'll look at the comments of people who have visited a place, and she might do what the judges in the Olympics do. She throws out the high, she throws out the low, she looks at the mean. So people are accustomed to seeing, there's an occasional gripe. That's life. Any business that doesn't have a gripe isn't in business.
Right, absolutely. Yeah, I would be suspect of one that has, you know, all 5-star ratings and nothing negative said. You know, and I won't take you to task on infringing on my trademark by announcing Lee's Cookies when you told me it was Paul's Cookies earlier.
Well, you know,
as we said too, you know, the timeliness within social media is a key factor. It's one of the reasons why me personally, I'm not crazy about these automated posts that are done through various software and stuff that put out these messages on a very periodic basis, because I always have this fear factor that what happens if a customer posted something, a negative comment, really upset. And when you think about, I heard a statistic the other day with respect to moms with school-age children are spending upwards of 7 hours a day online, with the majority of that time being spent on their mobile phone. And I'm thinking that, you know, God forbid, you know, they leave a business, they walk 20 feet to their Suburban, they get in, the emotions are riding high, and they immediately post on the Facebook page how unhappy they are. They're basically trembling, and I'll get real dramatic here with this, so you could really picture it. And then all of a sudden, before her complaint is responded to, an automatic post goes on right above hers. Now she gets ticked off because she's thinking that she's being ignored.
Yeah.
I mean, the timeliness of things is just so crucial. And moving forward, we've got a lot to cover, and I probably could have you on for about 4 more shows with all we've prepared for. But, you know, kind of a new spin on the age-old advertorial is article marketing and brand journalism, and something really bites at me, you know, where a third-party writer, probably a better word is promoter, creates some type of newsy article promoting a franchise brand, and then it's distributed through, you know, Twitter, news feeds, through various blogs, et cetera. And oftentimes might even have earnings claims buried in there where, you know, the franchisor or a franchise sales agent, whether it be internal or a broker, can point to it. I mean, what are your thoughts on that whole new practice that's really gaining speed and frightfully so?
Well, it raises a host of really serious issues, but it's a timely question because just last week, the Federal Trade Commission brought an enforcement action against the company in the what it alleges is the fake news business. And John Stewart needn't worry; these are businesses that were touting a particular product as a weight loss product. The problem was that in many instances they used paid promoters, advertorials, if you will, blog writers and the like, and didn't identify clearly enough or at all that they were paid to promote. The FTC has taken an interesting approach. When it issued this regulation or this guideline that said that you have to give disclosure if you're a paid promoter, they took special note of the fact that online sites, social media and social networking sites, have developed a higher degree of rapport with their readers. And they said that it's really a more intimate and a more trusted environment than typically is the case. It was interesting in many respects that the commission noted that. I come from the commission at the inception of my career. I was kind of impressed to see that they had come a long way in that regard, and I think they're absolutely dead on. So if you do have a paid promoter, or if you have an employee who goes on and says, this is fantastic, this is the best cookie business I've ever been in or otherwise, you've got a couple of things going. If you don't disclose, if they don't disclose their affiliation or their compensation, even if it's just an employee, arguably, you've now exposed the company as well as the promoter, both, to the possibility of FTC enforcement action. And the second one is, if they're going to be doing things like discussing earnings claims, which are now called financial performance representations, it's a lot sexier to call them earnings claims, but FPRs, or they're going to be providing other information, those statements may be ones that are going to be directly attributed back to the franchisor. And they're not going to simply be those of a promoter or an individual who comments. And that could be a potentially substantial issue for a company who's otherwise got nothing really of any concern other than, you know, that a customer promoted them by saying something nice on their site. When it turns out it's a paid endorser, it takes on a whole different meaning.
Yeah, you know, there's even someone out there that basically promotes themselves as brand journalist that has actually stated on LinkedIn that, you know, the biggest issue for franchisors when it comes to social media is being able to come up with all the content. And his opinion is, well, that's all you do is place articles strategically and then just get the franchisors to point. And it's really very frightful because a lot of them, you know, do have FPRs and different things in there. And of course, you know, it leads to a whole different arena, you know, especially, you know, from a franchise recruitment standpoint. I mean, do you expect the FTC, whether it be from a consumer standpoint or a franchise recruitment standpoint, do you see the FTC at any time increasing its enforcement with regard to all this?
Well, I think we're at an interesting crossroads. This very week, you've had several things happen. You've had several FTC public workshops on the issue of in the last year on the issue of data, on the issue of credit practices, on the issue of use of data. You, in the last week, have had the disclosure, which may or may not be news, but it certainly is making a splash, with respect to the location gathering capabilities of iPhones, Android phones, and even BlackBerries. And then just this week we've had the issue with respect to the potential data breach concerning PlayStation users. There will be, in my judgment, bipartisan efforts this year, literally bipartisan efforts, surprisingly in Washington, to address data protection rules. And this is all part of it, because what it comes down to is not just data, but also trust and confidence online. And people are not going to be willing in the legislative and in the regulatory arenas to simply let these matters rest with a short effort. I think the FTC will be active in pursuing these matters. They have been in the last several years. And industry may feel compelled to ask them to move faster, because anything that's a threat to the notion of trust and confidence is a threat to those businesses' ability to communicate clearly and effectively with their customers. It harkens back to the day I sometimes use this in when I'm making a presentation. It harkens back to the day when people used to know the person who they were buying things from, sort of the Sam Drucker phenomenon from the old CBS television shows. You knew who was selling things to you. You trusted they were selling you something pure. If you were buying a sack of flour, you knew you were getting flour. And the proprietor on the same in the same vein knew that, you know, if they sold you a sack of flour, you'd pay them. That trust and confidence has to be part and parcel of a remote transaction. And the more that you've got in terms of fake endorsements, facts that aren't true, data abuses, and things of that nature, the worse it is for legitimate businesses. So I think you're going to see a coming together of many different groups to try to see this moved forward in a constructive way that would be benefiting not just consumers, but also businesses that are trying to do the right thing in the first place.
Well, I think that's great. You know, as I often say in talking with clients, you know, people still buy from people, especially with respect to, you know, consumers that come into franchise locations, as well as potential franchise candidates. And there's so much out there online that's very methodical, very strategic, and people in franchising really need to understand that both consumers and franchise candidates of today are certainly more educated and sophisticated and technologically advanced than ever before, but they're also more diligent, and that A to Z sales process has changed dramatically over the years. If you look strictly from a franchise recruitment standpoint, you know, somebody went to a local trade show, maybe they picked up this quarter's issue of Franchise Handbook, they picked out a couple of franchise brands, they called them up on the phone and said, you know, hey, I saw your ad and I'm interested. And of course the envelope came out and the four color brochure went in it, it was mailed, the salesperson tapped his fingers on his desk for 3 days, picked up the phone and called them, and the process started. With so much information online today, that A to Z process, by the time the candidate actually gets in touch with a live person, they might already be at letter P in the process. And to go to the people buy from people, that transition needs to be seamless and very open from the virtual world to the in-person world. And the best way to maintain that type of seamless transition is through consistency. And what better to promote consistency than the good old honest truth?
It's a pretty strong argument.
It is a strong argument. And, you know, and since the old rules still apply to new things like social media, you know, why is it that it seems so many franchisors, sales executives, and brokers act as though franchise pre-sale compliance doesn't apply in the social media environment?
Well, that's a very good question. There's a phenomenon that's gone on for years that has been observed as drop your guard informality in, for example, the use of email, where you have people who are willing to say just about anything in an email on the theory that it's just private communication between two individuals. It's easy to send and the like. Of course, the problem with that is that emails can just as easily be forwarded. And we usually tell people when they're doing those sorts of things, never send an email that you wouldn't be comfortable seeing on the front page of tomorrow morning's newspaper. The same holds true for other things you do online, whether it's in a conventional website or on a social networking page or a social media page. Of course, the tougher part about doing it in one of those contexts is that stuff is preserved for a very, very long period of time, if not forever. It certainly is cheaper to preserve data than it is to delete it. The cost of storage is remarkably low, and everybody who's tried to ever slim down their Outlook inbox knows that it's far more costly time-wise to do that than it would be to simply add another couple of gigabytes of memory. So what, you know, a foolish statement made, let's say, for example, a flat-out illegal financial performance representation that's made and preserved, now not only taints the person to whom it was directed, but ostensibly anybody else who reads it. So if you've got a franchise salesperson who on this day, on the 28th of April, 2011, responds and says, yeah, you're absolutely right, these units do roughly $750,000 in gross revenue a year, but in the location you're looking at, I think it could even go higher than that because of the demographics, you ought to figure on 1.2 a year. Now, leaving aside that that's not right in the first place, the problem with it is it's there and it's preserved for all time. It's not a private communication between two people. And it may be that in a year's time, that person didn't buy the franchise. They realized it was something that wasn't for them, didn't like dealing with the salesperson, for whatever reason. But in a year's time, somebody goes to look for that franchise's information and discovers that. And they go, holy crow, that's exactly what I'm looking for. And on the strength of that, they express their interest and they go and they buy. Well, that creates all kinds of interesting liability a year or so down the road with respect to a foolish statement made a year or even more before that. You really can't have salespeople going off on a wild tear and doing that without realizing that the consequences could be rather dramatic.
Yeah, Jonathan Redgrave last week was talking about, you know, e-discovery, and he brought up a statement that just blew me away, but, you know, I realized the legitimacy of it is that all tweets right now are being archived by the Library of Congress. So they ain't going away,
no.
And God knows how long others are going to be, and I agree with you, and it's usually to the detriment of the person standing on the sidelines when the first posts are made that might have something illegal in there or illicit, and it might not be the person that they're actually responding to. And I know, and I've repeated this story a couple of times, but it's worth repeating. I saw a LinkedIn discussion going on about 2 years ago, and of course LinkedIn was just gaining speed, and it was in a franchise group, and somebody, an interested party outside of franchising, posted a discussion and said, I'm in transition, and I'm thinking of buying a franchise. Can people really make money as, you know, buying a franchise? And, of course, there was, you know, a couple of the banter back and forth. You know, attorney said, you know, about the FDD and pointed them in different directions. And some young upstart franchisor jumped on there with full enthusiasm, I can't describe it anyway, said, you know, we've just been franchising for the last year and a half or so, and I'm happy to say we got 12 franchisees, and they're all making money, and franchising is great, and blah, blah, blah. And I was thinking, oh, my God, you know, and it might not be to the detriment of the person that originally posted this discussion, but maybe somebody on the sideline says, oh, I ought to look at this brand, and they go buy it, and, you know, we know the consequences later on, or potential consequences. Subsequently, I was speaking to a franchise. I was actually the Women's Franchise Network group in Houston, and I brought that up, and I heard a gasp, and it was somebody in the audience, and it was that person. It was that franchisor that had said this, and of course, she immediately said, I remember that, but it wasn't intentional. It, you know, it wasn't planned. I was just so excited about franchising. You know, again, when it comes down to black and white, it's black and white. You don't have the opportunity then to do all the explaining after the fact. And, you know, with that in mind, I mean, have we seen any litigation arising out of social media that you think franchisors should take note of?
We're still seeing the tip of the iceberg in terms of things that are percolating up. I know of a few potential claims. The one that's, I think, the most notable over the last year is not in franchising per se, but it's litigation involving whether a company was legitimately able to fire an employee over statements that the employee made on a personal Facebook page. And the National Labor Relations Board challenged the firing, saying that effectively you were disciplining somebody for making private comments to their friends about whether they did or didn't like their employment, and that it was a violation of the employee's rights under the National Labor Relations Act. The parties ultimately reached a settlement, but not before there was a splashy set of headlines, because the NLRB won the case in the first several instances before in which it went before an administrative law judge and then a judge. So I guess the answer is the story is yet to be written in that regard, but I think all of the cautions that we have not only been discussing, but that we've seen over the last the decade or two or three in terms of how franchisors and franchisees interact with one another, as well as with their customers, all of those apply in this context. The fact that it's a different medium doesn't change the rules. It's the same set of rules, even as applied to the online social networking and social media world.
Yeah, and you bring up a good point regarding, you know, the employment aspect, because, you know, one of the questions that arose out of last week's discussion with Redgrave was, you know, people on LinkedIn giving recommendations to other people, and it's, you know, the question, are you representing the person you work for? Maybe this was a previous employee. I mean, it's just so many different things. You know, as we're getting to the top of the hour, and I knew we would blow by this hour just like you and I sitting in fireside chairs with a couple of glasses of Cabernet, which I could go for right now. How do you use social media personally and professionally, Lee?
Well, it's an interesting thing. First of all, at a personal level, I got to say that it's been a wonderful thing for me. I've been able to enhance the relationships I have with friends, old and new, and I've enjoyed it tremendously. And I love my friends' jokes. But at a professional level, you use it to share information with people who you think would be interested in hearing it. The key to all of it, though, and I think one of the things that people ought to remember, is it's not a question of how often are you out there. The question is, are you adding value? If you're not adding value to the discussion, either at a personal level or at a professional level, then think twice about whether you should hit the post button. It's got to be something relevant, because otherwise people are going to look and they're going to, oh, it's another post by that guy. Last time he sent something out, it was useless. I'm ignoring this one too. It's much like the same as on any context. The ABA listserv, for example, when somebody continuously posts meaningless and useless content, we just hit the delete button. And I think you've got to make sure that if you're going to post something personally or professionally, however you think it's best for you, whatever strategy you pursue, it's got to be something that's valuable to the reader. Otherwise, don't do it.
Yeah, I hate the people that get on and that's all they do is sell, 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 sell.
Yeah.
And my response to them is, you know, would you walk into an in-person network and put up a sign and say, I'm here to sell such and such? And no, you're going to develop relationships. You're going to basically work towards earning the right to share what's on your mind. And ultimately, as people gain some trust in you and they realize the value, they'll want to do business with you, and you'll eventually do business with them. Trying to sell straightforward on it, certainly not going to work. And as I said, Lee, it always amazes me how fast an hour flies. We're certainly almost out of time, and I really appreciate you being my guest today and for taking the time to do so and sharing some very important and interesting information. I'd love to have you on in the future.
It's absolutely a pleasure, and I look forward to that. Thank you so much, Paul.
To Joe Caruso, thank you again for all you're doing for helping make Franchise Today a leader in franchise media. May I remind our listeners, as you're on Facebook, Franchise Today is also now on Facebook. Please stop by and like us. I remember next week my guest is Warren Lee Lewis as the second annual Franchise Legal Series continues. Until then, my name is Paul Segretto, wishing you the best, the very best, in this great thing we call franchising. Franchise Today is out.